The following program is not a production of Audio Journal. External programs like this are selected with the interests of our audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed in this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
Hello, this is Susan from the Talking Information Center. Today is July 8th, 2026, and I'll be reading selections from the Diabetes Update. Our first article is sourced from the Karolinska Institute, and it's titled, "This New Diabetes Pill Burns Fat Without the Downsides of Ozempic." A newly developed pill could offer a fresh approach to treating type 2 diabetes and obesity. Early research suggests it may help lower blood sugar and increase fat burning without reducing appetite or causing muscle loss, two common concerns associated with some current weight loss medications. The findings, published in the journal Cell, come from researchers at Karolinska Institute and Stockholm University. Unlike popular GLP-1 medications such as Ozempic, which are delivered by injection and work by influencing appetite signals between the gut and brain, the new treatment takes a completely different path. Instead of targeting hunger, the experimental drug activates metabolism inside skeletal muscle. Researchers say this approach improved blood sugar regulation and body composition in animal studies while avoiding several side effects often linked to GLP-1 therapies, including appetite suppression, muscle loss, and digestive issues. The treatment is taken as a tablet rather than an injection. The researchers also conducted an initial phase 1 clinical trial involving 48 healthy volunteers and 25 people with type 2 diabetes. According to the study, participants tolerated the treatment well. "Our results point to a future where we can improve metabolic health without losing muscle mass. Muscles are important in both type 2 diabetes and obesity, and muscle mass is also directly correlated with life expectancy," says one of the researchers behind the study, Tor Bengston, professor at the Department of Molecular Bioscience, Wenner-Gren Institute, Stockholm University. The drug is built around a laboratory-developed molecule known as a B2 agonist. Researchers engineered the compound to activate important signaling pathways in a new way that benefits muscle tissue without excessively stimulating the heart, a challenge that has historically limited the use of B2 agonists. "This drug represents a completely new type of treatment and has the potential to be of great importance for patients with type 2 diabetes and obesity. Our substance appears to promote healthy weight loss, and in addition, patients do not have to take injections," says Shane C. Wright, assistant professor at the Department of Physiology and Pharmacology at Karolinska Institute, who is one of the researchers behind the study. "Because the new treatment works differently from GLP-1 medications, researchers believe it could be useful both on its own and alongside existing therapies. This makes them valuable both as a standalone treatment and in combination with GLP-1 drugs," says Shane C. Wright. "The next step will be a larger phase 2 clinical trial led by Atrogi AB, the company developing the drug. Researchers hope to determine whether the benefits observed in preclinical studies can be replicated in people living with type 2 diabetes or obesity." Our next article is sourced from the Endocrine Society and is titled, "Scientists Found a Surprising Problem with Sugar-Free Diets." giving up sugar entirely may not be as beneficial as many people assume. New research presented Saturday at ENDO 2026, the Endocrine Society's annual meeting in Chicago, suggests that completely removing sugar from the diet could have unintended effects on gut and metabolic health. Researchers from the Dasmond Diabetes Institute in Kuwait examined what happened when mice were fed a low-fat diet that contained no sucrose, a common form of sugar. The study compared those animals with a control group that received a low-fat diet containing sucrose over a 16-week period. Completely removing sucrose from a low-fat diet may unexpectedly disrupt gut health and promote inflammation and metabolic dysfunction, highlighting that balanced nutrition is more important than simply eliminating sugar, said Rashid Ahmad, Ph.D., principal scientist and head of the Immunology and Microbiology Department at the Dasmond Diabetes Institute in Kuwait City, Kuwait. The institute was founded by Kuwait Foundation for the Advancement of Sciences. To evaluate the effects of eliminating sucrose, the researchers measured glucose tolerance, insulin sensitivity, circulating metabolic hormones, the gut microbiome, and inflammation in both the colon and liver. Despite maintaining similar body weights, mice on the sucrose-free diet experienced several negative health changes compared with the control group. These included poorer glucose control, insulin resistance, imbalances in gut microbes, intestinal inflammation, and changes associated with fatty liver disease. The findings suggest that complete removal of sucrose from a low-fat diet may negatively affect gut microbiota and metabolic health, Ahmad said. The study highlights the importance of maintaining balanced dietary carbohydrates to support gut and immune homeostasis. According to the researchers, little was previously known about the potential consequences of highly restrictive low-fat diets that eliminate sugar entirely. This research may influence future dietary recommendations by emphasizing the importance of maintaining a healthy gut microbiome rather than focusing only on sugar restriction, Ahmad said. In the long term, these findings could help improve strategies for preventing and managing metabolic disorders, fatty liver disease, and chronic inflammatory conditions. The team believes the results underscore the need to consider overall dietary balance rather than concentrating solely on reducing sugar intake. Studies such as this reflect our institute's commitment to advancing evidence-based scientific discoveries that improve public health outcomes and deepen our understanding of metabolic disease, said Faisal Hamed Al-Refai, MD, Acting Director General of Dasmond Diabetes Institute. Our next article is sourced from Mass General Brigham and is titled, New GLP-1 Diabetes Pill Delivers Major Weight Loss and Blood Sugar Control. A new experimental GLP-1 pill could make it easier for people with type 2 diabetes to access treatments that help control blood sugar and support weight loss. At the American Diabetes Association's scientific sessions, Mass General Brigham researcher Vanita Arota, MD, presented results from Solstice, a phase 2B randomized placebo-controlled clinical trial evaluating the oral GLP-1 receptor agonist elecoglipron. The findings were published simultaneously in The Lancet. The study found that elecoglipron significantly lowered blood glucose levels and reduced body weight in people with type 2 diabetes. Researchers say the results highlight the growing potential of oral GLP-1 medications to address some of the limitations associated with current treatment options. Our study's findings underscore the expanding potential of oral GLP-1 receptor agonists for people with type 2 diabetes, said Arota, who serves as Director of Diabetes Clinical Research in the Division of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Hypertension within the Mass General Brigham Department of Medicine. To date, GLP-1 therapies have largely been limited to injectable or oral peptide formulations, each with inherent delivery and dosing constraints. Rigorous clinical trials like Solstice can help us evaluate oral medications that may be just as effective for patients with diabetes while overcoming these limitations. Elecoglipron was developed specifically for the treatment of type 2 diabetes. Most currently available GLP-1 medications are given through subcutaneous injection, while semaglutide is available as an oral option for people with type 2 diabetes. It must be taken first thing in the morning on an empty stomach, and patients must avoid food and water for 30 minutes afterward. Another oral non-peptide GLP-1 medication, orforglipron, has been approved in the United States for weight management. Sponsored by AstraZeneca, the Solstice trial enrolled 406 adults with type 2 diabetes across 9 countries, including the United States. Participants were randomly assigned to different treatment groups, allowing researchers to evaluate a range of starting doses, dose escalation approaches, and maintenance doses. After 26 weeks of treatment, elecoglipron lowered glucose levels significantly more than placebo across all tested doses. Up to 89.6% of participants receiving the medication achieved an HbA1c level of 7%, the standard target goal for average blood glucose levels over the past 2 to 3 months for most adults with diabetes. By comparison, 24.9% of participants in the placebo group reached that target. The drug also produced meaningful weight loss. Up to 72.3% of people taking elecoglipron achieved at least a 5% reduction in body weight, compared with 20.2% of those receiving placebo. Researchers reported that the medication's safety and tolerability profile was generally consistent with other GLP-1 therapies at this stage of development. Arota also serves as principal investigator for Reimagine 1, a randomized controlled trial evaluating CagriSema, a combination therapy that pairs the amylin receptor agonist cagrilintide with injectable semaglutide. Results from that study were also presented at the ADA meeting and published in The Lancet Diabetes and Endocrinology. The trial showed positive outcomes with up to 87% of participants reaching the HbA1c level of 7%. At the center of every one of our clinical trials is the goal of improving outcomes for patients, said Arota. The studies being presented at this year's meeting highlight how essential carefully designed trials are for evaluating new therapies, refining existing approaches, and ensuring that advances in science translate into safer, more effective care for people living with diabetes. Our next article is sourced from The Conversation and is titled, 10 Surprising Ways Diabetes and Dementia Are Connected. The link between diabetes and dementia is becoming increasingly clear. New research shows how blood sugar problems affect brain health and vice versa. Here are 10 evidence-based insights into how the two conditions are related. Number 1. Diabetes raises the risk of dementia. People with diabetes are about 60% more likely to develop dementia than those without, and frequent episodes of low blood sugar are linked to a 50% higher chance of cognitive decline. Number 2. Insulin resistance affects the brain, too. Insulin's resistance, the major cause of type 2 diabetes, happens when cells stop responding properly to insulin. That means that too much sugar, in the form of glucose, is left in the blood, leading to complications. It usually affects the liver and muscles, but it also affects the brain. In Alzheimer's, this resistance may make it harder for brain cells to use glucose for energy, contributing to cognitive decline. Number 3, a brain sugar shortage in dementia. The brain is only 2% of our body weight, but uses about 20% of the body's energy. In dementia, brain cells appear to lose the ability to use glucose properly. This mix of poor use of glucose and insulin resistance is sometimes unofficially called type 3 diabetes. Number 4. Alzheimer's can raise diabetes risk. People with Alzheimer's often have higher fasting blood glucose, even if they don't have diabetes. This is a form of pre-diabetes. Animal studies also show that Alzheimer's-like changes in the brain raise blood glucose levels. Also, the highest genetic risk factor for Alzheimer's, the APOE4 genetic variant, reduces insulin sensitivity by trapping the insulin receptor inside the cell, where it cannot be switched on properly. Number 5. Blood vessel damage links both conditions. Diabetes damages blood vessels, causing complications in the eyes, kidneys, and heart. The brain is also at risk. High or varying blood glucose levels can injure vessels in the brain, reducing blood flow and oxygen delivery. Diabetes can also weaken the brain's protective barrier, letting harmful substances in. This leads to inflammation. Reduced blood flow and brain inflammation are strongly linked to dementia. Number 6. Memantine, a dementia drug born from diabetes research. Memantine, used to treat moderate to severe Alzheimer's symptoms, was originally developed as a diabetes medication. It didn't succeed in controlling blood glucose, but researchers later discovered its benefits for brain function. This story shows how diabetes research may hold clues for treating brain disorders. Number 7. Metformin might protect the brain. Metformin, the most widely used diabetes drug, does more than just lower blood glucose. It gets into the brain and may lower brain inflammation. Some studies suggest that people with diabetes who take metformin are less likely to develop dementia, and those who stop taking it may see their risk increase again. Trials are testing its effects in people without diabetes. Number 8. Weight loss injections may reduce plaque buildup. GLP-1 receptors agonist drugs such as semaglutide, such as Ozempic and Wegovy, lower blood glucose and support weight loss. Records show that people with diabetes on these drugs have a lower dementia risk. Comparing GLP-1 drugs to metformin, studies have found that they were even more effective than metformin at reducing dementia risk. Two major trials, EVOKE and EVOKE Plus, are testing oral semaglutide in people with mild cognitive impairment or early mild Alzheimer's. Number 9. Insulin therapy might help the brain. Since insulin resistance in the brain is a problem, researchers have tested insulin sprays given through the nose. This method delivers insulin straight to the brain while reducing effects on blood sugar. Small studies suggest these sprays may help memory or reduce brain shrinkage, but delivery methods remain a challenge. Sprays vary in how much insulin reaches the brain, and long-term safety has not yet been proven. Finally, number 10, SGLT2 inhibitors may lower dementia risk. New evidence suggests that compared to GLP-1 receptor agonists, SGLT2 inhibitors, a type of diabetes drug, are superior at reducing dementia risk, including Alzheimer's and vascular dementia, in people with type 2 diabetes. These tablets lower blood sugar by increasing sugar removal in urine. This study builds on early evidence suggesting they lower dementia risk by reducing inflammation in the brain. This growing body of evidence suggests that managing diabetes protects more than the heart and kidneys. It also helps preserve brain function. Questions remain whether diabetes drugs only reduce the diabetes-associated dementia risk or whether these drugs could also reduce risk in people without diabetes. However, diabetes research has been very successful in creating at least 13 different classes of drugs, multiple combination therapies, giving rise to at least 50 different medicines. These reduce blood sugar, improve insulin sensitivity, and reduce inflammation. A side effect may be better preservation of brain health during aging. Our next article is sourced from Medical News and is titled, Blood Test May Predict Dementia Up to 25 Years Before Symptom Onset in Women. A blood test measuring the levels of the pTau217, a protein associated with Alzheimer's disease-related brain changes, could predict the risk of dementia in older women up to 25 years before symptom onset, reports a new study published in JAMA Network Open. Ian McDonough, PhD, associate professor at State University of New York at Binghamton, who was not involved in the study, said, "The study suggests that pTau217 has good, but not great, predictability of all-cause dementia/MCI. The farther out one tries to make predictions, the harder it can be. By identifying concrete evidence that one's risk is elevated earlier in life, one can still have time to change one's lifestyle. For example, better sleep, less stress, more exercise, more cognitive and social engagement, to reduce that risk for subsequently developing dementia," he told Medical News Today. The study also showed how factors such as age, race, and genetic predisposition influence the association between pTau217 levels and the risk of dementia. This study furthers our understanding of pTau217's association with dementia risk in real-world settings beyond the controlled conditions of clinical trials. The diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease is based on assessing cognitive and neuropsychological function, followed by examining structural changes in the brain and, increasingly, measuring Alzheimer's biomarkers. Hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease include the aberrant accumulation of the beta-amyloid and phosphorylated Tau proteins into amyloid plaques and Tau neurofibrillary tangles, respectively. Core Alzheimer's disease biomarkers include those that reflect the accumulation of the amyloid or Tau proteins and damage to brain cells. Until recently, these biomarkers of Alzheimer's disease have been evaluated using brain imaging scans or by measuring changes in the composition of amyloid beta or Tau proteins in cerebrospinal fluid that bathes the brain. Brain imaging scans are expensive and require specialized equipment, whereas collecting cerebrospinal fluid samples is invasive. Blood-based biomarkers have emerged as a promising, cost-effective, and minimally invasive alternative to these techniques. These Alzheimer's biomarkers indicate the deposition of amyloid beta plaques and neurofibrillary tangles in the brain rather than clinical symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, with their appearance preceding cognitive decline by years. Thus, these biomarkers can be used to assess the future risk of cognitive decline due to Alzheimer's disease and potentially facilitate the use of interventions before symptom onset. One such blood-based biomarker is pTau217, one of several phosphorylated Tau species that has emerged as one of the most accurate plasma biomarkers for Alzheimer's disease. Plasma pTau217 is an accurate indicator of the extent of amyloid beta and neurofibrillary tangle accumulation in the brain and can reliably track cognitive decline due to Alzheimer's disease. Additionally, plasma pTau217 is as reliable as cerebrospinal fluid biomarkers. Most data on plasma pTau217 accuracy have been obtained from clinical trials conducted under standardized conditions, and there is insufficient evidence on its performance in the general population. An increasing number of studies have been conducted in community settings to better understand the association between plasma pTau217 and the risk of mild cognitive impairment, MCI, a precursor to dementia or dementia. The present study further examined the association between baseline plasma pTau217 and the future risk of mild cognitive impairment or dementia over a follow-up period of up to 25 years in community-dwelling participants enrolled in the Women's Health Initiative Memory Study. The researchers also assessed whether the association between plasma pTau217 levels and dementia risk was influenced by factors such as age, race, and genetic predisposition for Alzheimer's disease. The study included 2,766 cognitively healthy women ages 65 to 79 years at its onset in the late 1990s. These women were originally a part of two clinical trials to examine the impact of hormone therapy in the form of either oral estrogen or a combination of estrogen and progesterone on dementia risk. Among the 2,766 women, 1,311 participants developed either mild cognitive impairment or dementia during the follow-up period, ranging from 1 to 25 years. Consistent with previous research, the present study found that women with higher pTau217 at baseline were more likely to develop dementia or MCI during the follow-up period. Notably, the researchers also found that Alzheimer's disease risk factors such as advanced age and genetic predisposition interacted with the plasma pTau217 levels to result in elevated risk of MCI or dementia during the follow-up period. Specifically, the association between pTau217 levels and the risk of dementia or mild cognitive impairment was stronger in participants older than 70 years than in those younger than 70 years, and in women carrying the APOE4 gene variant, which is associated with increased Alzheimer's disease risk than in non-carriers. In other words, the risk of MCI or dementia associated with pTau217 levels was influenced by age and genetic predisposition. Although Black Americans are at a higher risk of dementia, the present study found that white women with higher plasma pTau217 levels were more likely to develop dementia or MCI than their Black counterparts. Plasma pTau217 levels in combination with age were a better predictor of the risk of MCI or dementia than pTau217 levels alone. Furthermore, plasma pTau217 levels in combination with age were similarly reliable in predicting dementia risk in Black and white women, but were less accurate in predicting MCI in Black women. These results suggest that plasma biomarkers are not going to be a one-size-fits-all forecasting solution. We need to better identify subgroups of older adults as well as middle-aged adults for whom these plasma markers might be most predictive and those for whom they could even be misleading, like Black Americans, because they might suggest a low risk for dementia when in fact they are at high risk, said McDonough. The study also reported a stronger association between dementia or MCI risk and higher PTAU217 levels among women treated with estrogen combined with progesterone than placebo. These results are consistent with the WIMS clinical trials, which show a greater risk of dementia in women using estrogen combined with progesterone. It must be noted that the levels of PTAU217 are associated with the levels of amyloid beta plaques and tau tangles, and not all individuals with elevated Alzheimer's biomarkers develop Alzheimer's disease in their lifetime. Moreover, other hurdles remain to the integration of blood-based biomarkers in clinical practice, including the interpretation of results and the standardization of procedures. Our next article is sourced from the Mayo Clinic and is titled Diabetes Diet: Create Your Healthy Eating Plan. A diabetes diet is a healthy eating plan that helps manage blood sugar. Use this guide to get started, from meal planning to counting carbohydrates. A diabetes diet simply means eating the healthiest foods in moderate amounts and sticking to regular meal times. It's a healthy eating plan that's naturally rich in nutrients and low in fat and calories. Key elements are fruits, vegetables, and whole grains. In fact, this type of healthy eating plan can be good for most people. If you have diabetes or prediabetes, your healthcare professional will likely recommend that you see a dietitian to help you develop a healthy eating plan. The plan helps you manage your blood sugar, also called blood glucose, manage your weight and heart disease risk factors. These factors include high blood pressure and high cholesterol. When you eat extra calories and carbohydrates, your blood sugar level rises. If blood sugar isn't managed, it can lead to serious issues. These issues include a high blood sugar level called hyperglycemia. If this high level lasts for a long time, it may lead to long-term complications such as nerve, kidney, and heart damage. You can help keep your blood sugar level in a safe range. Make healthy food choices and track your eating habits. For most people with type 2 diabetes, weight loss also can make it easier to manage blood sugar. Weight loss offers a host of other health benefits. If you need to lose weight, a healthy eating plan provides a well-organized, nutritious way to reach your goal safely. A diet for people living with diabetes is based on eating healthy meals at regular times. Eating meals at regular times helps your body better use insulin than it makes or gets through medicine. A registered dietitian can help you put together a diet based on your health goals, tastes, and lifestyle. The dietitian also can talk with you about how to improve your eating habits. Options include choosing portion sizes that suit your needs for your size and activity level. Make your calories count with nutritious foods. Choose healthy carbohydrates, fiber-rich foods, fish, and good fats. During digestion, sugars and starches break down into blood glucose. Sugars are also known as simple carbohydrates, and starches are also known as complex carbohydrates. Focus on healthy carbohydrates such as fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes such as beans and peas, low-fat dairy products such as milk and cheese. Avoid less healthy carbohydrates such as foods or drinks with added fats, sugars, and sodium. Dietary fiber includes all parts of plant foods that your body can't digest or absorb. Fiber moderates how your body digests food and helps manage blood sugar levels. Foods high in fiber include vegetables, fruits. For the most fiber benefit, eat whole fruits rather than drinking fruit juice. Nuts, legumes such as beans and peas, and whole grains. Eat heart-healthy fish at least twice a week. Fish such as salmon, mackerel, tuna, and sardines are rich in omega-3 fatty acids. These omega-3s may prevent heart disease. Avoid fried fish. If you are pregnant, are planning to get pregnant, or are breastfeeding, do not eat fish that's typically high in mercury. This includes shark, swordfish, king mackerel, and tilefish. Foods containing monounsaturated and polyunsaturated fats can help lower your cholesterol levels. These include avocados, nuts, canola, olive, and peanut oils. But don't overdo it, as all fats are high in calories. Diabetes raises your risk of heart disease and stroke by raising the rate at which you develop clogged and hardened arteries. Foods containing the following can work against your goal of a heart-healthy diet. Saturated fats. Avoid high-fat dairy products and animal proteins such as butter, beef, hot dogs, sausage, and bacon. Limit coconut and palm kernel oils. Trans fats. Avoid trans fats found in processed snacks, baked goods, shortening, and stick margarines. Cholesterol. Cholesterol sources include high-fat dairy products and high-fat animal proteins, egg yolks, liver, and other organ meats. Aim to keep dietary cholesterol as low as possible through healthy eating rather than aiming for a specific milligram limit. And sodium. Aim for no more than 2,300 milligrams of sodium a day. Your healthcare professional may suggest you aim for a smaller amount if you have high blood pressure. You may use a few different approaches to create a healthy diet to help you keep your blood sugar level within a typical range. With a dietitian's help, you may find that one or a combination of the following methods works for you. The American Diabetes Association offers a simple method of meal planning. It focuses on eating more vegetables. Follow these steps when preparing your plate. Fill half of your plate with non-starchy vegetables, such as spinach, carrots, and tomatoes. Fill a quarter of your plate with a lean protein, such as fish, lean pork, or chicken. Fill the last quarter with a carbohydrate, such as brown rice, or a starchy vegetable, such as green peas. Include good fats, such as nuts or avocados, in small amounts. Add a piece of fruit or a serving of dairy and a drink of water or unsweetened tea or coffee. Because carbohydrates break down into sugar, they have the greatest effect on your blood sugar level. To help manage your blood sugar, you may need to learn to figure out the amount of carbohydrates you are eating with the help of a dietitian. You can then adjust the dose of insulin accordingly. It's important to keep track of the amount of carbohydrates in each meal or snack. A dietitian can teach you how to measure food portions and become an educated reader of food labels. You also can learn how to pay special attention to serving size and carbohydrate content. A dietitian may recommend you choose specific foods to help plan meals and snacks. You can choose a number of foods from lists that include categories such as carbohydrates, proteins, and fats. One serving in a category is called a choice. Each food choice has about the same amount of carbohydrates, protein, fat, and calories, and the same effect on your blood sugar as a serving of every other food in that same category. For example, carbohydrate lists that include starch, fruits, and milk have choices that are each 15 grams of carbohydrates. Some people who live with diabetes use the glycemic index to select foods, especially carbohydrates. This method ranks foods that contain carbohydrates based on their effect on blood sugar levels. Talk with your dietitian about whether this method might work for you. Embracing a healthy eating plan is the best way to keep your blood sugar level under control and to prevent diabetes complications. And if you need to lose weight, you can tailor the plan to your specific goals. Aside from managing your diabetes, a healthy eating plan offers other benefits too. Because this plan recommends generous amounts of fruits, vegetables, and fiber, following it is likely to lower your risk of cardiovascular diseases and certain types of cancer. And eating dairy products and other foods rich in calcium can help keep bones healthy and strong. If you live with diabetes, it's important that you partner with your healthcare professional and dietitian to create an eating plan that works for you. Use healthy foods, portion control, and a schedule to manage your blood sugar level. If you don't follow your prescribed diet, you run the risk of blood sugar levels that change often and more serious complications. Our next article is sourced from Medical News and is titled Type 2 Diabetes. New studies highlight three helpful foods and natural remedies. Type 2 diabetes is a chronic condition affecting metabolic health, which occurs when the body no longer produces enough or responds to insulin, leading to elevated blood sugar. The treatment for type 2 diabetes typically involves a combined approach of targeted medication and lifestyle changes, particularly by adhering to diets that help maintain a healthy weight and keep blood sugar and LDL, or bad cholesterol, levels in check. Research recently covered on Medical News Today now suggests that a handful of common foods and natural remedies may help keep various aspects of diabetes or health problems associated with this chronic condition in check. Here is what the latest research has found. A study conducted by researchers at the University of Bonn in Germany, whose findings appeared in Nature Communications in January 2026, suggests that a low-calorie, two-day oatmeal diet could significantly lower LDL cholesterol levels. For this study, the researchers conducted two parallel, randomized, controlled clinical trials involving participants with metabolic syndrome, a complex condition many of whose characteristics overlap with those of diabetes, namely elevated blood pressure, high cholesterol levels, high blood sugar, and overweight. The authors found that participants who had consumed an oatmeal diet consisting of 300 grams of oatmeal per day for two consecutive days saw a 10% reduction in LDL cholesterol levels at the end of this period. Participants following this two-day oatmeal diet could supplement their meals with fresh vegetables or fruit, and the overall diet resulted in them slashing their typical calorie intake by half. Even though participants later returned to their usual diets, their cholesterol levels remained lower at 6 weeks following the intervention. According to senior investigator Marie-Christine Simon, Ph.D. and R.D., these effects were likely due to the fact that the high dose and rapid exposure to oat components, especially phenolic compounds that are metabolized by the gut microbiota, can trigger stronger biochemical responses than a modest daily intake. This large oat load significantly increased microbially produced phenolic metabolites, especially dihydroferulic acid, which were associated with the cholesterol reduction, Simon suggested. However, Michelle Ruthenstein, MS, RD, CDCES, and CDN, a preventive cardiology dietitian at Entirely Nourished, who was not involved in this research, issued a caveat emphasizing that in small, tightly managed settings, it is easier to observe pronounced short-term changes than the more gradual LDL improvements typically seen when oats are incorporated into everyday free-living diets, where many other factors are also at play. Regularly including moderate amounts of oats within a heart-healthy eating pattern, alongside other sources of soluble fiber, plant protein, and overall nutrient adequacy, continues to be a practical and evidence-based way to support LDL lowering and cardiometabolic health without the need for extreme or short-term dietary approaches, Ruthenstein advised. This research, which received funding from the Haas Avocado Board, was a secondary analysis of data from the Habitual Diet and Avocado Trial, which involved participants with an elevated waist circumference who were at least 25 years old. The dietary intervention involved eating a large avocado every day for 6 months. Participants in the control group ate two or fewer avocados per month for the same duration. At the end of the intervention period, the researchers found that participants who had eaten one large avocado per day had a lower dietary glycemic load, a measure of diet-induced blood sugar elevation, than their peers. According to Karen Z. Berg, MS and CDN, a registered dietitian who was not involved in this study, avocados are a nutrient-dense food and have many health benefits. They are high in calories, monounsaturated fats, and fiber. Avocados are very, very filling, so when people eat more avocados, they are likely eating less of other foods that are possibly less healthy. This could be why this study had such positive outcomes. Besides high blood sugar levels and heightened cholesterol, high blood pressure or hypertension is another health issue that is often associated with type 2 diabetes, affecting 50 to 80% of people living with this chronic condition. Depending on how serious this health issue is, people can treat it with both medication and natural interventions on a case-by-case basis, following medical advice. One lesser-known natural remedy for hypertension highlighted in the current research is peppermint oil, a type of essential oil. One group of participants, randomly selected, received 100 microliters of peppermint oil per day, and the other, the control group, received a peppermint-flavored placebo for 20 days. At the end of this period, those taking peppermint oil had not only lower systolic blood pressure, but also lower resting heart rate. Lead study author Jonathan Sinclair, DSC and PhD, explained that he and his colleagues were interested in peppermint oil because peppermint contains biologically active compounds, particularly menthol and flavonoids, that have plausible relevance to blood pressure regulation. According to Sinclair, menthol can activate TRPM8 channels, which are found in vascular and sensory tissues, and this activation may contribute to vasodilation through calcium-dependent endothelial signaling, nitric oxide-related pathways, and relaxation of vascular smooth muscle. In simple terms, peppermint oil may help blood vessels relax, which could reduce the pressure against which the heart has to pump. Other experts, however, have urged some caution and called for further research to replicate these findings provide clearer information on the mechanisms of action. For example, Craig Bassman, MD, FACC, and FSCAI, Associate Director of the Structural and Congenital Heart Program at Hackensack University Medical Center in New Jersey, who was not involved in this study, noted that a study with more participants would provide more robust data and help to confirm these initial findings. It would also be beneficial to see longer-term studies to understand if the effects of peppermint oil on blood pressure are sustained over time and to identify any potential long-term side effects, Basman emphasized. Our next article is also sourced from Medical News and is titled Weight Loss Drugs Slash Risk of Four Types of Cancer by 50% or More, Study Finds. As interest in GLP-1s continues to grow, researchers are beginning to examine how these medications might affect a person's health beyond diabetes management and weight loss. Hundreds of millions of people are taking or will soon take GLP-1 medications for the treatment of obesity and diabetes. Aparna Kamat, MD, Director of the Division of Gynecologic Oncology at Houston Methodist Hospital, told Medical News Today. That scale means even an unexpected benefit or an unexpected harm becomes a public health event. We have an obligation to understand the full biology of these drugs, not just the intended effect. Identifying additional benefits could help us understand the biological pathways influenced by these drugs and uncover new opportunities for disease prevention and treatment, including cancer prevention, said Kamat. Kamat is the senior author of a new study published in the journal Annals of Oncology that found a potential link between taking GLP-1 medications such as Ozempic, Wegovy, Zepbound, and Mounjaro, and a decrease in the overall risk of developing obesity-related cancers in people without diabetes. For this study, researchers analyzed the health data from a national database of more than 229,000 obese, non-diabetic people. Most previous studies examining GLP-1 medications and cancer risk were conducted in patients with type 2 diabetes, Kamat explained. However, the majority of individuals now receiving GLP-1 medications are using them for obesity management and do not have diabetes. This is the population that has been invisible in the literature, and it is now the largest group using these drugs. They are younger, they don't have diabetes, and they are experiencing some of the sharpest increases in obesity-associated cancers we've seen in decades, she said. Those types of cancers are breast, colorectal, endometrial, esophageal, gallbladder, kidney, liver, meningioma, a type of brain tumor, multiple myeloma, ovarian, pancreatic, stomach, and thyroid. Between December 2014 and June 2025, 38% of study participants received a GLP-1 prescription, and the remaining 62% received diet and exercise counseling. At the study's conclusion, researchers found that participants who took GLP-1 medications containing semaglutide or tirzepatide had a 41% decrease in their overall risk of developing an obesity-related cancer. A 41% reduction across more than 229,000 patients is not a small signal, Kamat said. This is the kind of number that, in any other context, would already be driving clinical guidelines. Kamat and her team found even higher cancer risk reductions in specific cancers, including a 58% lower risk of endometrial cancer. Endometrial cancer is rising fastest in younger women. It is tightly linked to obesity, and we have almost nothing to offer for prevention, Kamat explained. A 58% reduction is extraordinary. If that holds up in prospective studies, it changes how we think about this disease entirely. And this finding provides a strong rationale for further mechanistic and clinical studies focused on endometrial cancer prevention and treatment. The most dramatic drops in risk, where this reduction was by 50% or more, also occurred in multiple myeloma, pancreatic cancer, and colorectal cancer, in addition to endometrial cancer. We are not ready to say these drugs prevent cancer. Our study cannot prove causation, but we are ready to say this finding demands a serious answer. Given the rapidly increasing use of these medications, even a modest reduction in cancer incidence could have important public health implications. When asked how GLP-1s might help lower obesity-related cancer risk, Kamat said it's probably a combination of weight loss and other factors. Separating them is one of the most important questions in the field right now. We know GLP-1 receptors are expressed directly on certain cancer cells. That means the drug could be acting on the tumor itself, not just shrinking the patient, she said. If that's true, weight loss is not the whole story, but weight loss is likely an important contributor because excess adiposity promotes chronic inflammation, hormonal dysregulation, insulin resistance, and other processes linked to cancer development. Determining the relative contribution of these mechanisms remains an important area of ongoing investigation, she explained. David Greenberg, Section Chief of Hematology and Oncology at Hackensack Meridian Jersey Shore University Medical Center in New Jersey, who was not involved in this study, commented that he was not surprised by the study's result, as we've known for decades that lifestyle, obesity, and toxic exposures play a critical role in the development of cell mutation and cancer. My cardiology colleagues have promoted GLP-1 drugs for several years to potentially improve a patient's overall health, Greenberg told Medical News Today. We know these drugs not only diminish appetite and aid weight loss, but they also likely affect cardiovascular health, improve insulin sensitivity, and thus decrease overall inflammation in the body. Anything that decreases inflammation likely also decreases a person's overall cancer risk. So I believe other factors are at play besides losing weight. Medical News Today spoke with Lauren Karkus, MD, a medical oncologist with Miami Cancer Institute, part of Baptist Health South Florida, about this study's findings, who commented that while they're exciting, the data must be interpreted in context. The observational design of the study allows for potential confounding of results as it does not take into account socioeconomic status, physical activity levels, dietary quality, and health-seeking behavior from the persons evaluated, Karkus, who was not involved in the study, explained. Additionally, the results have only a median 2-year follow-up. Most obesity-associated cancers have a longer latency, meaning that the recurrence of the disease may not occur within the time frame evaluated, she added. Anton Bilchik, surgical oncologist, chief of medicine, and director of the gastrointestinal and hepatobiliary program at Providence St. John's Cancer Institute in Santa Monica, California, who was not involved in the study, agreed. Obesity is a well-established risk factor for numerous cancers, including colorectal, pancreatic, liver, uterine, ovarian, and breast cancers, Bilchik detailed. It is therefore reasonable to hypothesize that a sustained weight loss could reduce cancer risk. While findings from this new study are encouraging, more robust and long-term research is needed before physicians can confidently prescribe GLP-1 medications to non-diabetic patients with obesity, specifically for cancer risk reduction, he said. This has been Susan from the Talking Information Center with your diabetes update for today. Thank you for listening.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
This is not a public service announcement. This is a one-minute mystery.
Art Kahn and Hardy Pyle waged a bet on who could stay underwater the longest without the aid of any breathing apparatus. Hardy jumped in the pool and managed to stay under for 1 minute. Art knew he could never beat Hardy's time using his method, but he did win by staying under for 2 minutes using an old trick. What did Art do?
And here's the solution to our mystery.
Art Kahn filled a cup with water and stood under it for 2 minutes.
And now back to our regular programming.
Would you like to hear news from Shrewsbury, Northborough, Southborough, and Westborough that you're not likely to hear on commercial television or radio? Then tune in to Audio Journal every Tuesday at 4 p.m.